From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we look at the political realities of authority during this pandemic. Then we mark Earth Day with a look at how the movement has been embraced over the last 50 years.
There's such power in individual action, and I want people to be inspired and feel that sense of agency and empowerment and unite to address this challenge.
Plus, there were a lot of skeptics when electric bacteria were discovered, but that turned out to be a blessing.
The really great thing that happens when you publish something that's a little bit controversial is everyone who doesn't believe it tries to repeat it and show you're wrong. And then when they repeat it and show you're right, they become your colleagues.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Since Governor Evers announced he would be extending his Safer at Home order, there's been a lot of pushback. There have been some small-scale protests in cities like Brookfield and Madison. Some Wisconsin sheriffs have come out in opposition of the order. And yesterday, the Republican-led legislature filed legal action against the order. At the heart of this fight, like the fight over the April election, is really this simple question. Who has the power to do what? Who's in charge? It might be a simple question, but as Philip Rocco will tell you, there isn't a simple answer. Rocco is an assistant professor at Marquette University, where he teaches courses on American politics and the policymaking process. He joins me now from his home. Philip Rocco, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Great to be with you, Joy.
So this is a situation that's pretty unprecedented in modern history. So from the beginning, there have been a lot of open questions about who's in charge and what they can do. The question I had when really all of this really started to culminate was, how did we prepare for a situation like this? Had we prepared, our government, had it prepared for a situation like the one we're currently confronted with?
Yeah, well, one way of thinking about it is that really from the founding, we've given state governments and local governments power to do things that are necessary to protect public health. That's why when the 10th Amendment reserves what are effectively called police powers to the states, things like quarantine laws, for example, you know, have a very, very long history. In fact, really even one of the first, you know, major sort of defining constitutional cases in the Supreme Court, Gibbons versus Ogden, I think it mentions even quarantine laws as something that's sort of definitively within the power of state governments. Now, obviously, things have changed a lot since, you know, the early 19th century, and there was a sort of wave of revisions to state emergency preparedness laws sort of after 9/11. And the major thing, you know, to note about what state governments have the capacity to do is that they have the capacity to sort of respond in a comprehensive way to manage public health emergencies, especially emergencies related to infectious diseases when they arise. And so that's why, you know, when Governor Evers puts out a Safer at Home order, he's not just sort of coming up with his authority to do that on the fly. That authority rests in a chapter of Wisconsin state statutes called Chapter 252. And that just sort of explicitly is like a playbook for how the state should respond when a public health emergency arises.
Well, and that gets to a big question, I think. There's been this overriding question about whether or not Governor Evers really has the power to do anything by himself. When he wanted to postpone the election, he was told he didn't have the power to do that. Now that he wants to keep the stay-at-home order in place, you know, there are some who are saying that he doesn't have the power to do that, although he obviously did have the power to create the initial stay-at-home order. What kind of emergency powers does the governor have at the moment?
The thing that I'll note here is that because the governor's public health emergency powers are very large, they're extensive. And you know, I would encourage listeners, you know, if you're interested or bored, you have some time at home, go and look at chapter 252 of the state statutes. It gives the governor a pretty substantial amount of power to create emergency rules when something like COVID-19 arises. Now, obviously, there's a sort of political battle in the country that's going on about, you know, are these emergency measures too extensive? Are they too draconian? Now, the battle is going on not in public opinion. Public opinion is at present vastly in support of maintaining these sorts of measures, keeping businesses and schools closed as this crisis goes on. I think in Wisconsin, the Marquette poll has public support for that at around 86%, whereas I think about 10% of respondents think that the governor has gone too far. Rather, the conflict is between sort of the president's party, Republicans, and Democrats. So I think the challenge now is that Republicans are trying to find ways of creating more political support where it doesn't exist to push for sort of economic reopening beyond what public health officials see as sort of advisable at this point in time. And so what we're seeing in Wisconsin is that battle is playing out not through the legislature trying to pass a new law that says it has the authority to do something, but actually using the Supreme Court and challenging the governor's authority, which again is pretty clearly prescribed within state statutes, but they're trying to challenge that in court rather than trying to actually sort of make the public and political case that the order has gone too far.
Yeah, so they're trying to contest it through the courts. Of course, they just did this with the decision to postpone, or rather not postpone, the election. If they're successful, what would that mean for the office of the governor here in Wisconsin, but potentially nationally?
I think if Republicans are successful challenging this at the court, it would have pretty broad implications for what the governor could do under a variety of emergency scenarios, which I think is kind of distressing, especially given that the revision of many state statutes happened sort of after 9/11 in response to the possibility of bioterrorism. I mean, I think that depending on, you know, how the court rules, if it rules in favor of Republicans in this case, which I think hasn't even been briefed yet or filed, I think it could have major implications for what the governor can do in a situation like this. Beyond the state of Wisconsin, I think it's sort of important to consider that when states sort of open up their economies in a situation where they're not able to sufficiently control, test or do contact tracing for the virus, it creates feedback effects for other states. Obviously, states are sort of interconnected and people go across state lines, and that could have ramifications beyond the state of Wisconsin itself.
Well, and that gets to another question. Where does the buck stop ultimately? What is the chain of command in this situation? Is the governor, you know, the final wall there, or who's in charge?
Well, I mean, let me try to answer that question in two ways. As far as the law goes, in an emergency scenario like this, and it varies a little bit from state to state, but in general, the governor is really where the buck stops. The executive branch has extensive authority in emergency scenarios. And again, this is like really clearly spelled out in black letter law in the Wisconsin state statutes, for example. However, authority and power are two different things. Just because the Constitution gives the governor the power to do something, it doesn't necessarily mean that the politics of the scenario are going to allow that to be the final action. And I think that what we're seeing right now is that Republicans in the state of Wisconsin are in a place where they, number one, don't have the authority to do what they want to do. They don't necessarily have the political support statewide to do that either. And so I think what they're trying to do here is create a set of scenarios that changes the political dynamic, that actually puts them in a better position politically. One, by sort of taking the decision to a venue which they know has been very friendly to them in the past. If you think about the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, it is, with very few exceptions, pretty reliably friendly to the demands of the Republican state legislature. And there's still a balance of power on the court, despite the results of the April 7th election that advantages Republicans there. Additionally, I think that Republicans are trying to change the dynamic of hearts and minds. There have been these protests in Madison, for example, and they really haven't included that many people. It doesn't really represent a large number of people who are, you know, willing to go out there and do that kind of work, nor does it really represent anything more than a very, very small sliver of public opinion. However, the hope is that I think by getting a lot of coverage on those people, they sort of amplify the idea that this is really a divisive partisan issue rather than one on which most people in fact agree that it would be better to have the public health situation under control before any sort of major resumption of any kind of normal economic activity commences. I think what this entire debate is so sort of focused on the politics of the governor's emergency order that it leaves out these bigger questions about resources, the resources the state needs to actually do the kind of testing and contact tracing necessary to reopen the economy. And I think that by really making this about this one issue, the governor's authority to use his powers of emergency management, it really leaves out what public health officials around the state and around the country know is a really, really important criterion to get states where they need to be.
Yeah, there's been a conversation, of course, right now about whether or not Election Day had a big impact on spreading the coronavirus. But of course, we don't have widespread testing, even for people who have symptoms. If they're still mild, if they don't have to be hospitalized for them, they won't be tested. So it's we're having this conversation without having the facts a lot of the time.
Right. And I think this is why the really sort of unfortunate thing about this is that by framing the issue as a contest between do you reopen the economy or do you keep it closed, we're missing a really important dimension of the entire puzzle, which is there are things that the federal government needs to do to give states the capacity to open again. Many of the measures that are included in the White House guidelines for reopening really hinge on this question of, are there adequate testing capacities? Are we able to do the kind of contact tracing that allows us to know whether or not we've had a true decline in the rate of cases? Because, of course, many people are, in fact, asymptomatic carriers. And so I think that it's really sort of important not to lose sight of the fact that this is really a multidimensional problem. And when we start focusing on one dimension, we really lose our ability to see a fuller picture of the puzzle.
Yeah. So to take a kind of step back, you know, we're talking about the stay-at-home order, and with that comes some idea of enforcement. Right now, how are they enforcing this order?
Right. So that's a really good question. And the thing that I'll know, I'll just start with the law. Wisconsin State Statute Chapter 252.25, which says that any person who willfully violates or obstructs the orders related to public health shall be imprisoned for not more than 30 days or fined not more than $500 or both. Now, obviously, this is something that in practice can be very, very difficult to implement. And in many cases, using this sort of the sharp edge of government's power to do that kind of implementation is sort of self-undermining because it causes people to, you know, maybe question the legitimacy of government decisions in the first place. And of course, you know, with the imprisonment part of that, this is not a time where we want to be filling up more jail cells and increasing the risk of community spread that way. So the main approach that law enforcement has taken around the state is I think what sheriffs refer to as an educational approach. So if there are very clear instances of violation, information is provided, there's a sort of strong word of encouragement there, but it's not as if anyone currently is being arrested or penalized in a very severe way for violating these rules. The idea is that law functions not only as that sharp stick, but also as a set of social norms, that it's a good idea if everybody tries to voluntarily adhere to this rule. Now, that works as long as there's a very high level of cohesion among people in our community's trust to tell them about what they should be doing in this emergency. The concern emerges when there are conflicting messages from political leaders, from law enforcement and public health officials about how people should be thinking about how to keep themselves safe. Our ability to actually rely on people's voluntary compliance with the rule diminishes. And so I think to preserve the ability of the government to not have to rely on these very punitive measures, which again may be self-undermining, it's necessary to have a sort of level of social cohesion in the messaging that I think we're really not familiar with having in our sort of very divided, divisive political context.
So with that idea of division, there are some police who are saying they won't enforce the new stay-at-home order. If they don't, then what happens? Is there anyone else who can enforce it?
Well, the first thing to note is that these statements of sheriffs around the state, there are not many sheriffs that have taken that position. And even among the sheriffs who have come out and said something critical about the Safer at Home order, not all of them have taken the position that they are not going to enforce it. And again, I think practically speaking, it was already the case that they weren't going around and sort of issuing a lot of citations for people not obeying the order. The practical effect of some sheriffs, and again, I should emphasize it's a very, very small minority of sheriffs saying that they're not going to enforce the order or the order is somehow illegitimate or unnecessary to abide by, could be that people in those particular localities are less likely to regard the order as legitimate and less likely to adhere to it. And so we begin to see cases increase, maybe deaths increase in those particular places. And if that's the case, I would suspect that there would be some recourse that the governor could exercise some authority to use the National Guard, for example, in an extreme case. Although I think, again, the governor doesn't want to have to do that. That's a very costly and unfortunate position for the governor to be in. So I think the hope here is that ultimately these communities, despite the sheriffs coming out and sort of making these statements, continue to adhere to social distancing voluntarily.
Well, and I don't think any of us want to see people dying.
Well, right. And I think the important thing to note is that sheriffs do not have the authority, as some of the sheriffs who have come out and said this have said, they don't have the authority to be the interpreter of the Constitution or the state statutes. They have to follow what the letter of the law is. Now, of course, they can contest those statutes. They, you know, can participate in lawsuits related to those statutes, but the courts are where we deal with those things. And of course, you know, there's a, I think, a sort of history in the United States about the sort of political use of public health. And I think it's a concern that people have. Will political officials try to use public health measures to their own advantage? There's a case from 1900 where the city of San Francisco used a quarantine as a means of racial prejudice against the Chinese community. And so there is that sort of history there. But, you know, the fundamental fact is that the courts are where we deal with those issues. Sheriffs have a responsibility to not just sort of uphold the letter of the law, but I think also a sort of moral responsibility to emphasize sort of what is the kind of action that will keep a community safe. And it's, I think, disturbing to me as somebody who thinks a lot about public health to see a sort of a division among local civil servants on exactly what counts as an action that will keep people safe. And so my hope is that, you know, these incidents where we're seeing really sharp division among our elected officials and among even our sort of appointed officials on what is necessary to maintain, you know, public health and safety, that conflict is minor and is sort of a blip on the radar screen, and that ultimately we have a lot of convergence among the people that most of us trust to tell us, you know, what is necessary to sort of protect health and safety in this sort of very dangerous time. In the absence of that, and especially as this issue is made more conflictual, I think the ramifications for public health could be very dangerous.
Yeah. Well, Philip Rocco, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing some of your work.
Great to be with you, Joy. Stay well.
Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, where he teaches courses on American politics and the policymaking process. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Today marks the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. The Safer at Home order has prevented any large gatherings to celebrate, so many are finding ways to mark the occasion virtually. Gaylord Nelson, who served as Wisconsin's governor and a U.S. senator, is the founder of Earth Day. Nelson's daughter, Tia Nelson, is carrying on her father's legacy. She helped coordinate a short film to highlight Earth Day's half-century milestone. Nelson spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz, about the film and the history of Earth Day.
It's an important part of the Earth Day story. My father's trip to Santa Barbara to personally look at the devastation of what was then the largest oil spill in American history. And he got on a plane after that visit and picked up a Ramparts magazine in which the cover story was about how anti-war teach-ins on campus were changing the national discourse on the Vietnam War, and that was his aha moment. The actual journey to that moment was much longer and circuitous and involved many setbacks and disappointments in my father's earlier career. Keep in mind that he'd served as two terms as governor and had earned the moniker the conservation governor for promoting a penny a pack tax on cigarettes to fund the acquisition of public recreation land in Wisconsin. He was elected to the Senate, went off to Washington. He took with him a scrapbook of all the good press he'd gotten for his conservation initiatives as governor, and tried to convince fellow members of Congress that it was a winning issue and that fell on deaf ears. He persuaded President Kennedy to go on a conservation tour, and the president agreed. This was in 1963, a few months before the president was assassinated. And they went on that tour. I have some correspondence between Arthur Schlesinger, who was chief of staff to the president at the time, asking my father for ideas for the president to speak to. But the tour was a failure and a great disappointment to my father. And it was cut short, canceled early on, as I recall. And so my father's journey to this idea of an environmental teach-in, which got renamed wisely, renamed Earth Day, that journey was much longer, but it was an aha moment for him when he was thinking about how youth were changing the national discourse on a critical and divisive issue in America at the time, namely the Vietnam War.
So this was an extremely tumultuous period of U.S. history, and your dad was trying to push this policy to protect the environment.
Well, yes, and it's interesting to reflect just how tumultuous that decade leading up to the first Earth Day was. The civil rights battles, the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy in 1968 and of Martin Luther King, and the divisiveness of the war itself. And so we were living in quite tumultuous times and as a very politically divided country. And for me, that's an interesting thing to reflect on now as we experience hyperpartisan and divisive, politically divisive time today. Earth Day managed to inspire a sense of unity around critical environmental issues at the time in a way that was successful beyond my father's wildest dreams.
So 20 million people participated in the first Earth Day.
Yes, that is the estimated number of people involved, and that would have made it the largest secular event in history.
I've heard the University of Michigan had a lot to do with Earth Day's momentum.
Yes, in the prologue to Adam Rome's book, The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation, a fabulous book and resource, in the prologue, the first event that Adam speaks about was the one that occurred in Ann Arbor, Michigan on March 11th, 1970. And there were 14,000 people gathered at the university's basketball arena for the kickoff of their teach-in. And they began with the cast of the musical Hair singing Let the Sunshine In. The governor spoke. Barry Commoner gave the keynote address. And it was certainly a significant harbinger of things to come.
So one of the ways you hope to bring attention to Earth Day's 50th anniversary is through a short film. How did you settle on that idea?
When I was reflecting on the 50th anniversary, I wanted to do more. Of course, I felt a great sense of duty to tell my father's story and inspire youth of today to see the power of individual action that was so well demonstrated that first Earth Day. But I didn't want to just reflect on the past. I wanted to tell a story that was relevant to contemporary times and to inspire people to think about what we want Earth Day to look on like on the 100th anniversary. And there were several critical elements in the first Earth Day. It was multi-generational. Though driven by youth energy, it was multi-generational, it was bipartisan, and my father gave a striking call to social and environmental justice in his speech on that first Earth Day, which he gave at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee campus. And we use a clip from that speech to tell the story, and I certainly hope inspire the youth of today. And so I reflected on how to best do that, and I had been come a great admirer of the work of Varshini Prakash, co-founder of the Sunrise Movement, one of the most powerful youth activist groups in the country, and had come to see the work of a former Republican congressman and evangelical Christian, Bob Inglis, who had been a climate change skeptic and has now dedicated his life to addressing the climate change crisis. And he founded a group called Republic EN. And I thought that Varshini's voice and Bob's voice would be perfect bookends to this story in that they demonstrated the multi-generational and bipartisan elements that were so critical to the success of the first Earth Day.
Unfortunately, despite multiple attempts, I wasn't able to reach Varshini Prakash, co-founder of the Sunrise Movement. I'll hope to talk with her another day. But Bob Inglis and I did chat. He shared a bit of his story, how he shifted from climate change denier to believer. It happened when he served in the U.S. Congress.
Well, for my first 6 years in Congress, I said that climate change was nonsense. I didn't know anything about it except that Al Gore was for it. And inasmuch as I represented an extremely conservative district in South Carolina, that was the end of the inquiry. I admit that's pretty ignorant, but that's the way it was for 6 years. I was out of Congress for 6 years doing commercial real estate law. Had the opportunity to run again in 04 for the very same seat. And my son, the eldest of our five kids, came to me, and as he was voting for the first time that year, he just turned 18, and he said, "Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment." So that was an important first step in a three-step metamorphosis. Second step was going to Antarctica with the science committee and seeing the evidence there. Third step really something of a spiritual awakening in another science committee trip, interacting with an Australian climate scientist and being inspired by his faith and his commitment to love God and love people by caring for the creation. And so that Scott Heron is his name, was the reason I came home then and introduced the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009. My timing wasn't good to be proposing a carbon tax in the midst of the Great Recession when you represent a very conservative district in South Carolina. So I got booted out at a Republican primary and have ever since been working to convince fellow conservatives that there's an exciting free enterprise answer to climate change.
So you founded Republic EN as a mechanism to win over people who don't share your conviction that climate change is real but needs to be acted upon. Is your strategy to promote innovation and policy?
There are three ways to deal with climate change. You can regulate it, you can incentivize it, or you can price it. And regulate it, you know, that means it's you attempt to regulate down the emissions. You can incentivize it. That means that you give tax incentives for clean technologies. And then pricing it, which is the solution that we most prefer at republicen.org, is a very simple way of having the market reflect the true cost of burning of fossil fuels. And what you do is you just price that into products by a carbon tax. Now, of course, it's a rare day that you find a conservative saying, let's have a new tax. But this tax would be a special kind of tax. It's two things. It's revenue neutral. That means we would cut taxes somewhere else, or dividend all the revenue from the carbon tax back to the people, so there's no growth of government. And second, it would be border adjustable, which means that we would apply the tax to goods coming in from other countries that don't have the same price on carbon dioxide. China would likely object in the World Trade Organization, but we think they lose that case based on precedents in the chemical industry. And after they've lost, they would find it in their interest to implement the same price on carbon dioxide internal to China, so that when their goods are coming into the U.S., they're not paying a tax that's being remitted to Washington. They would have collected the tax, and the tax would have been remitted to Beijing. And then you've got the whole world following the American lead, not because of some protracted negotiations at the UN and some complicated agreement, but rather just a bold move by the United States that says, we're going to price carbon dioxide, and we think you're going to find it in your interest to do the same thing. But if you don't and you want to keep on paying our carbon tax, go right ahead, because we've got an enormous deficit and a tremendous debt. So we'd be glad to collect your money, collect taxes from you.
What's top of mind for you as we approach the 50th anniversary of Earth Day?
I think it's just remarkable how Earth Day was so successful in getting so many people aware of the degradation of our environment. And it's just remarkable the mobilization that occurred. And so what I hope in the 50th anniversary is that we would sense that same mobilization about climate change, that we would see that as the current biggest challenge. You know, in 1970, we had rivers on fire. We had effluent going into the rivers. It was of colors that don't occur in nature, you know, and when seen on TV, we could say, gee, that just isn't right. The challenge with climate change, of course, is it's slow moving. You don't see CO2. You can't taste it. You can't smell it. And so, oh, that we were able to see it. Then maybe it'd be like in 1970 when we're saying, gee, that color stuff should not be going into that river. And no, the river should not catch fire. So I just hope that we can have the same mobilization and be as successful as they were so successful in creating Earth Day.
Tia Nelson shares that same hope.
I want the youth of today to know that they have enormous power in individual action. And whether that is joining Republic EN, Bob Inglis's group, or joining the Sunrise Movement, Varshini Prakash's group, or joining the Citizen Climate Lobby, a bipartisan group dedicated to putting a price on carbon pollution. There's an organization for every political persuasion and approach to addressing the climate crisis. Of course, at the end of the day, the most important thing one can do is vote for local, state, and national officials, elect to office people who are committed to implementing sound climate change policies. And so I want people to recognize that the climate crisis is the biggest environmental challenge humanity has ever faced, and that there are any number of ways that the individual can get involved, from joining an organization to voting, living their own values, and thinking about how they do that. And there's such power in individual action, and I want people to be inspired and feel that sense of agency and empowerment and unite to address this challenge.
Tia Nelson is the daughter of Earth Day founder and former U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson. She's also the managing director of climate at the Outrider Foundation based in Madison. You also heard from Congressman Bob Inglis of South Carolina, who participated in the film and founded Republic EN. You can find a link to the film at WUWM.com. We'll take a short break now, then we'll learn about electric bacteria and the future of microbial fuel cells. More of Lake Effect Now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. If you hear the term electric bacteria, a lot of images may come to your mind. Some picture a post-apocalyptic scenario where electrified bacteria doom our species to extinction. But luckily for us, that's not the case. The reality is much more benign and potentially revolutionary. What started as a question about the metal content of a lake in upstate New York evolved into a new field of research that has changed the concept of biofuel and could alter the future of energy production. Dr. Ken Nielsen's team first found electric bacteria in 1987 with the discovery of Shewanella oneidensis, named after Oneida Lake, where it was found. Dr. Nielsen joined me to talk about his work last October. I'm going to start the conversation by stating emphatically that I am not a microbiologist. This is all material that's pretty out of, you know, my wheelhouse, but it's such a fascinating story and a fascinating topic. To really start here, what are electric bacteria?
Electric bacteria are I would say they're a rather new finding. Only in the last couple of decades have people realized that bacteria could take the energy from whatever they're eating. Usually they're eating glucose or things, some of the same things we eat, or they're feasting on dead material, different kind, protein, whatever. And instead of turning that energy into ATP to run their bodies, they harvest the energy by harvesting the electrons from whatever they're eating. And instead of using the electron energy, the electric energy, to grow faster, they can use it to export electrons to the outside. And basically, if there's an electrode around or a mineral that will take electrons, they can pass the electrons outside the cell. And 10 or 15 years after these bacteria were discovered, somebody had the sense to put an electrode in the flask, and the bacteria would just transfer their electrons to that electrode, making electricity.
Let me take a step back for a moment. So generally, they're using these electrons, if I'm stating this right, they're using that to grow bigger. But sometimes, instead of doing that, they just export it out of themselves, and then they can pass it on to something else?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the reason that these were discovered is that bacteria were doing something that they shouldn't be able to do, which was they were passing electrons to various minerals in the sediment and dissolving those minerals. And the thing about bacteria is they're designed to keep the electrons inside. But if you can't get rid of the electrons, you just suffocate. And so the way virtually all life works is you extract electrons from whatever you eat. And in our case, we pass those electrons to oxygen. And oxygen, we breathe it in and we breathe out water, which has been reduced by those electrons. So we're no different from the bacteria, except we haven't figured out how to pass those electrons onto an electrode and make energy. So we just pass them to oxygen. If you take the oxygen away from my bacteria, they will suffocate unless there's something else to give the electrons to. And in this case, they were giving the electrons to iron oxides and manganese oxides in completely altering the bottom of a lake.
There were people who were working on this lake, and they realized that something was going on that was atypical. They didn't think that it could be bacteria that was doing this. What made you think that the cause of the changes in this lake were due to bacteria?
Well, that's because I'm a microbiologist, and bacteria have a phenomenal ability to mutate and learn how to do new things if you put a lot of selective pressure on them. And down in these sediments, when they run out of oxygen, but there's all sorts of things that they could use instead of oxygen, except those things turn out to be solids. And bacteria can't take solids up because they're, number one, they're smaller than the solids usually, but number two, the solids can't get through the membranes on the bacteria. So the obvious solution is to pass the electrons to the outside. But back in the late 1980s, textbooks all said this couldn't be done.
So solids in this case, would they be like minerals, rocks, those kinds of things?
Yeah, the solids in this case are, if you would look at the surface of Mars and see all those rocks covered with rust, that would be a good analog of this. Anything that's rusty will be covered with iron oxides, and those iron oxides are far bigger than the bacteria, but they're a great source of oxidizing power. And they are a good oxygen substitute. It's just that it's the way science often works. If the textbooks say it's not possible, then no one tries it. So my geology friends told me about this lake in New York, Lake Oneida. And I spent one summer in the summer of 1987 with a group of students just doing culturing, trying to get to isolate bacteria that would in fact reduce these iron and manganese oxides. And by the end of the summer, we had organisms in culture that could do this perfectly well.
What I think is kind of amazing about this story is not just that, you know, bacteria did something that previously we didn't imagine they could do, but then how we were able to take that information and say, there's a practical purpose for us. And one of the things that you talk about at TED Ed was the idea of microbial fuel cells. How does something like that work?
It's so simple, Joy, that that it boggles the mind. Basically, you imagine that the bacteria swim up to this rock and they form a culture on the surface of the rock. And they take whatever is to eat in the water and they pass the electrons to the rock, which then dissolves the mineral. Now you take away the rock and you put an electrode there and you charge the electrode so that it's exactly the same voltage potential as that rock was. The bacteria swim up to the electrode, they eat whatever you give them to eat, and they pass the electrons. Basically, they're using the electrode as an oxygen substitute, and they're respiring the electrode. Now, if you just put that in a device, you can feed the bacteria on one side of the fuel cell, and all the electrons go to the other side where they interact with a catalyst and get oxidized by oxygen. I had a student from the engineering school, and she immediately saw this connection, and she developed the understanding of how the fuel cells work. And now she has her own company down in San Diego making these fuel cells to help clean human waste.
Yeah, that was the other part of this. It's not just that they can create electricity, they can also clean water.
Yes, that's right. If you imagine that bacteria can eat all these kind of nasty things that we call pollution, and that's what they do for a living. They eat almost any kind of organic material, including human wastewater. So they'll basically, in Oriana's fuel cells, in just a few days, she can get virtually all of the waste material out of wastewater and have it so that with just a small filtration, it'll be perfectly good for both irrigation and ultimately for drinking. And she's now marketing what she calls plug-and-play wastewater devices for use in outdoor toilets and all kinds of things like that. It's simple bacteriology in the sense that you can decide what it is that you want to design these fuel cells for. You can go isolate the bacteria that will do that, and then you can set up the fuel cell and get rid of whatever pollutant it is that you want to. So she has these now designed for human waste, for cattle waste, and for hog waste. Bacteria, all bacteria don't eat everything, but it really is just basic bacteriology. You have to find bacteria that can eat all the stuff you want and then get a good community of them on the electrode in the fuel cell. And then those bacteria basically form a biofilm that will take care of that human waste pretty much forever. We've had fuel cells growing on human waste in the lab for more than 3 or 4 years now never seem to run out of energy because we keep, once they use up all the wastewater, the waste in the water, we give them another feeding. And it really works very, very well. Our experiments in my lab, of course, are about 100 milliliters in the fuel cell. And Oriana's are several thousand gallons now.
It's amazing that they can be used for all these things. I mean, human waste, bovine waste, those kinds of industrial wastes more generally. You know, you're continuing to search for new bacteria that are able to do these kinds of things. What other kinds of bacteria have you found, and what have they been able to do?
Well, I think we're just at the start of a very, very exciting field. I have been reading several review articles by different people around the world. When this was discovered, the word electric bacteria hadn't been invented. And to be honest, no one believed it at first. I can't say that I blame them. The really great thing that happens when you publish something that's a little bit controversial is everyone who doesn't believe it tries to repeat it and show you're wrong. And then when they repeat it and show you're right, they become your colleagues and they start working with you. And that's really what's happened. There are hundreds of people now around the world that are working on these electric bacteria and using them. I'll give one example. They're using them to remove pollutants like chromium, like uranium, selenium, arsenic. There are all sorts of bacteria that will remove the electrons from these various pollutants. And when you get the electrons from them, they become insoluble. They precipitate out of solution. This is one example of the things that good geochemists will look at these bacteria that can speed up these reactions by factors of thousands and design things to help them get rid of polluting things.
Yeah, that's really amazing. I mean, it does seem like the uses for these bacteria are really endless.
Yeah, I think it's really in the mind of the beholder. And that's why it's so good that so many young people are being exposed to this right now. I just look at the number of papers being published. It really makes me feel good. I say we've started something that really is in its own way, going to change the world a little bit. And it's like so many things. First, it can't be true. Then, by golly, it is true. And then you say, well, I discovered it. And that's just fine. I'm happy to have them say that, because the new uses for this really are being discovered by the young people who believe in it. So, you know, in my sense, this is how science should work.
Well, Dr. Ken Nielsen, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and for sharing your work.
Oh, I'm happy to do that. And what can I say? Spread the word.
Will do. Dr. Ken Nielsen is a professor of earth and biological sciences at the University of Southern California. We spoke in October of last year when he came to Milwaukee to talk about his work. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.